Before we get started, we're going to have some travel desk reminders. There are four reminders. For student expense reimbursements, if the student needs to have direct deposit, they have to update their banking information in Minerva. If they're receiving reimbursement by check, the student's temporary address needs to be updated in Minerva. Otherwise, it'll be sent to their home address, and it's happened where a check was sent to Africa. So just remind your students to update their temporary address if they want to check reimbursement. Other reminders for expense reports, to remember to black out the credit card number because it's confidential. You can leave the last four digits, but just black out the rest. Digital signatures are not allowed, so if there's a digital signature on the expense report, it will be returned for a real signature. And also per diems, if per diems and receipts for meals and hotels, they're not allowed for anyone who resides in Montreal who's going to a Montreal conference. So if you're claiming per diems or receipts, it's not allowed. So don't even try to claim it on an expense report. The logic behind it is because if you reside in Montreal, you're basically eating breakfast at home, you're taking care of your lunch, and you eat at home for supper. So if you go to, if instead of going to the conference, you're going to work, you would, you know, take care of your own meals. So per diems are really used for overnight travel outside of Montreal. And now with some fun announcements, we would like to announce the next RAND meeting, which will be Monday, December 9th. This one's a really fun interactive session where we're going to celebrate our first year anniversary and have an interactive, thank you. We're going to have a Jeopardy session. It's really interactive. We would love everyone to participate. Continental breakfast will be served, and we will be sending a link right after the meeting to let you RSVP to let us know how many people will attend. And also 2014, we would like you to mark your calendars for approximately the third Friday of each month. We will be sending out a calendar in the next several weeks. And also for the December Christmas holiday, we would like to let you know that OSR will be closed for the 2 weeks. So that's December 21st, 2013 till January 5th inclusively. However, RFMS will be providing essential services for December 23rd, 24th, 2013, and January 3rd, 2014. Okay, so now I would love to present to you Elvi Coletta, our RFMS director, who's going to kick off our meeting and present to you life cycle of an audit.
So welcome, everyone. Before we get started, I would really appreciate it if you put your phones on vibrate, your cell phones, and I would really also appreciate if you don't have any side conversations because it is disruptive to those around you. So I appreciate you not doing that. And if you have any questions, you can raise your hand and we'll take questions throughout the presentation. So today's presentation is the life cycle of an audit. It's a little bit of a dry topic, but it's very informative. And I think it's a timely topic to be having because of the results we received from the latest tri-agency audit. Well, not latest, it was in 2010, and you've all heard about it throughout the year and all the recommendations they made, and we continue to work on implementing those recommendations. So it's a timely topic, and it's also at the end of the session, we covered 11 sessions, and we covered life cycle of grants, life cycle of CFI audits, and we went through all of those, and we talked about record retention. So this will summarize what happens when you have a research grant, what can happen at McGill University. And I have Brenda manning the fort here for me because I'm technically challenged. I can't do glasses and flip and talk at the same time. So she's decided to sit up here with me and keep me company. So thank you. So today's objectives. Next page. We're going to go over the definition of what is an audit, the roles and responsibility of an external audit. And it's all very formal, so I'm just going to speak in simple terms, but it's all here documented for you. The types of audits, the life cycle of an audit, and we're going to look at it as it relates to sponsor audits from our granting agencies. What is expected during an audit? What happens after an audit? Responding to an audit? how to prepare for an audit, and how audit helps us, because they do help us. Next page. Okay. So an audit is performed in accordance with set guidelines and policies that are put together by our granting agencies and sponsors and government corporations, whoever gives us any, whoever grants any monies to the researchers to do research at McGill. It's an examination of all our documents, so all our expense reports, payroll documents. It's to verify that it's in accordance with the set policies and that we're compliant and that we have the right record retention policies. And it's always performed by an independent auditor, and it's usually a certified public accountant. Or it's also, at times, the agency has their own CAs, and they send their own representatives to McGill University. So who can audit us and why an audit? We can have an audit by internal audit as well as external audits. For our FMS, we usually are dealing with external auditors most of the time because they're auditing research grants and contracts. Internal audit audits departments and faculties to ensure that they have the procedures, processes in place to manage their faculties and departments. And they do perform cyclical audits on departments and faculties, and they do provide a report with recommendations and observations. And those reports are shared with central finance as well. So internal audit, that is their function. External audits are normally because they're, the agency is sending them over to make sure that we are in compliance with their regulations, their set guidelines, that we have the controls in place to make sure the expenses are being processed, again, in accordance with those guidelines. So it always goes back to the guidelines. So the external auditor's role and responsibility is basically to ensure that we have all the controls in place. It is to provide constructive suggestions that can improve our processes where there are weaknesses identified. And they do play a key role on commenting on our weaknesses, and they also do point out best practices where there are best practices. So there are several types of audits. The one that we normally receive is a financial audit, and that is a verification of all our accounting records. So the auditors come in and they verify that the expense is eligible and that it is in accordance with the set guidelines and it is appropriate to the research being conducted. So it has to be related back to the research. One of those types of audits is also performed by Deloitte. Deloitte is our external auditors to the university, and they come and audit us on an annual basis. And they don't only audit the university financial statements, so the operations of the universities, but they pick an area of financial services to audit on a cyclical basis. So, for example, this year they did audit our FMS, and what they audit is to make sure that we have in place the controls for new funds. How do we set up new funds? They ask for that information. They ask for signed. They do pick research grants to review, but they're not reviewing them to see if the monies were spent in accordance with the set guidelines of the sponsor. They're more reviewing them to see if we have the controls in place to manage outstanding receivables, over expenditures, check received, and all of those types of controls. A compliance audit is just that. They're testing for compliance, so they're coming in and they're making sure that all the expenses incurred, again, are in compliance with the regulations of the sponsors, and to make sure that we have everything in place to support the researchers in their mission, and that they're spending those monies as they should be. Operational audit is to review the organization's operations. So again, it's all the controls, all the systems. Then we have what's called a fraud audit. We don't have many of these types of audits. although auditors do come in with open eyes and they do look for these types of expenditures that may be fraudulent in nature. Most of our audits are very good audits, and we may have ineligible expenses, but that doesn't mean that they're fraudulent. Fraudulent expenses is with intent. So someone sets to go and do something that should not be done on a research grant or contract or with any other type of funds at McGill University for that matter. So we have what's called the whistleblowing policy, I believe, and that is highly confidential. So if any one of us notices some wrongdoing and you think something's going on and you have a suspicion of something, you are allowed to whistleblow, and you do that with internal audit. And it is completely confidential. No one would ever know who blew the whistle, but they will go in and they will conduct a forensic audit, and they will write up a report, and they will take necessary action, especially even if it's done on research grants and contracts. And there has been an incident at McGill University. It was public. It was in the news. I'm sure you've all heard of it, where there was fraudulent activity on tri-agency grants. And it was a substantial amount of money, and we need to give that money back, and it's money that we do not have at this university. And that was nobody's fault. It was with intent. It was done, and the whistleblowing method worked. So that's how fraud audits work. And then there's the follow-up audit. So once an audit takes place, there is a follow-up audit a few years after we've implemented the recommendations. They give us time to do all of that, and they usually come back within 2 to 3 years to see that we have put things in place as they suggested. You could just click. So I'm just going to go over the audit cycle. So this is the flowchart of how it happens. There's a sample selection. We gather the documents. Then there's a preliminary report. We have a university response. Then there is a final audit report and implementations of the new control. So I'll just go over that in more detail. So all research grants and contracts are subject to audit. None of them can forego an audit. If the agency decides we're going to audit such a project, then they're going to audit such a project. It's usually a random selection of the projects that are being audited, and we're not given a lot of leeway, so we don't know a year before that something's being audited. We know today for tomorrow we're informed that there's going to be an audit. So what we've done is we've centralized in our FMS the audit process, because we were receiving a lot of requests haphazardly. Either the administrator was receiving the request or a supervisor or a faculty, and then there was no control on how we would put together the documents to provide to the auditors when they arrive on site. So we centralized that, and monitoring and compliance that reports to our FMS, led by Sonia, coordinates the entire audit effort once we're advised of the audit. So normally I receive an email from either the agency or the auditor that they've engaged to perform the audit on their behalf. And they specify the PI's name and the granting agency and the period that is being audited. So all that's predefined. And then what they ask us is to provide them with details of expenditures based on whatever period is being audited. And I just wanted to mention also that some audits are conducted remotely. So because of McGill's not the only entity that's going through budget cuts, so are our sponsors. And so what they used to do is they used to always come on site to perform an audit. So they'd come to our office for about a week, 3 days to a week usually is when they stay, the length of stay. And what they do now sometimes is that they ask us to scan the documents to them, and they perform what's called a desk audit. So they do that remotely. The visits at McGill are more rare, if you will, because of the budget constraints. So then once the period has been determined and the scope of the audit has been determined, we provide the ledger details to the auditor. Once that's done, they select an audit sample, so we could provide them reams and reams of details of expenditures, revenues and expenditures, and they may come back with a sample of 10, a sample of 30, and it's random sampling, and they can pick from any category, expense reports, salaries, a check deposit. They pick whatever they randomly select. So they don't go in and pick it themselves. It's a system that randomly selects those expenses that they want to see. Then RFMS monitoring and compliance will work with the financial administrator, the PI, and other central units to gather all the expenses. So if they select expense reports, we have to retrieve all our expense reports. If they select payroll items, then we need to go back to the departments for timesheets and offer letters and make sure that they're readily available. Same thing for Minerva appointment forms, P-card receipts, so on and so forth. And the auditors, when they do arrive at McGill, if they are conducting a site visit, sometimes we'll ask for an opening meeting where they want to meet with myself, usually with the controller, as well as the PI at times. They'll see whether or not that's necessary. And they go over with us the internal controls at McGill University, so procurement, MMP, our payroll system, expense report system. So all our systems that we have in place, our banner system for security, our approval queue. So we go through an entire evaluation of our internal controls because they want to make sure that that's sound and that we have whatever it takes that to administer these grants properly.
Yes. How far back will the agency come to do the audit? Like, is there a specific date? Is it an active file, or is it within 5 years?
So we're subject to audit at any time, and it could be throughout the entire life of the project, so while it's active and or once it's terminated, because technically we're supposed to keep our records 7 years at a minimum after, so they can choose to come after it's terminated. So there's a big length of time that they can come and audit us, and that's why we have to have all our ducks in order for when they do come. What we do shred immediately is our invoices. So once McGill pays a vendor, we scan the invoice so that those are kept indefinitely because they're scanned images, and then we destroy the original invoice. For all other documents, we do keep we keep them for 7 years at a minimum because that's the federal law. But for CFI projects, for example, we keep them from 10 to 12 years. Because CFI audits us way past the 7 years, and they're very big projects. Next slide. So what to expect during audits? So the auditor will explain all the documents that he or she wants to view during the visit, and we need to gather all of those before he or she arrives at McGill, or the team arrives at McGill, because sometimes it's more than one person, depending on how big the project they're auditing is. And what we like to do is make sure that all the documents we gather are perfect so that there is no room for questioning, no room to say we're not compliant, no room to say you're missing this or that. The auditors are very keen. They look at every single detail on a piece of paper, everything. So if the agency says we need this, they look for this. They're not going to say, oh, well, they're only missing this. No, it's going to be ticked as a non-compliant item. So some of the documents that they normally request, like I mentioned before, are expense reports, payroll backup, POP timesheets, and they want to see the PI's approval on everything. But in addition to that, they also do ask for the signed agreements. So if there was a CETA agreement, for example, they want to see the CETA signed agreement so that they can refer back to the terms and conditions set out by that agency. They would like to see also the if there were any sub-agreements to other institutions, they will ask for copies of those. They'll ask for copies of canceled checks. They'll ask for bank reconciliations, evidence of exchange rates if it's a U.S. grant. So they ask for a lot of things, worksheets, reconciliations. It's not just the expense report. It's not just the payroll item. They ask for other supporting working documents of that grant or contract. So what do we do during the audit? So during the audit, once we've provided the team with our nice package of all our evidence, and we know we're going to pass it with flying colors. We constantly keep brief notes. So during an audit, I will keep brief notes of the questions that they've asked so that we keep track of, did we give them the right response? Are we pending on a response? The documents they requested, what did we provide and what is still pending? And the discussions of more complex issues, because technically that might come into a report as an observation or comment. So it's good to keep track of every single thing that you've discussed with them. We also keep copies. So whatever we give to the auditors, we keep an identical package at Central, because they usually leave with our documents except for our expense reports, because those are our originals. We keep them here. But everything else they take with them. So we keep an identical package just in case in the report there's an observation that states maybe we didn't supply this or that. We can go back and say, yes, we did, here it is. So sometimes that happens, and it's only because of volume of paper that we're giving to the audit team. And then there is a brief wrap-up at the end of each day. So if they're here for a couple of days based on the larger projects, we always touch base with them at the end of the day to see what are the outstanding items, are there any questions, and are there any additional requests that they need? Is there anything else they need? Do they need other backup? Do they need to meet with the PI? Do they need to have a meeting with procurement? So if they do have additional requests at the end of the day, we take a tally of that, and then we organize ourselves for the next day. So during the audit, I know that audits seem intimidating, but you get used to them. I consider the auditors our friends, because they do help us. They really are. At the beginning of my career, I used to be intimidated by them. I didn't quite like it when we used to have an audit, but now I find it an opportunity to look inward at our systems, at our controls, at, you know, what are we doing well, because they do identify best practices, and what are we not doing so well, in order to improve and be the best that we can at what we do. So when they do ask us questions, we do need to respond them in a very honest, simple, and complete manner. So just answer the question. They're not authorities. You're not going to go to jail. You answer the question honestly and not like ongoing. So just answer, stick to the question. Don't, if they're not asking you a question, then don't answer an additional question. Just answer the question, because some people go on and on and on, and it's like they didn't really ask for all that information. And sometimes it just wastes a lot of time for no reason at all. Don't reply on memory alone. So sometimes we feel we need to answer the question right now because we feel we're under the gun, and they're there, and they're looking at you, and there's a team of them, and they're asking you questions. If you don't remember, it's fine to say, I need to go back and refer to my documents, because we have so many policies and procedures at McGill that we won't remember every little single detail and caveat in every single procedure and process. So it's fine to say, I need to go refer to my notes, and I'll get back to you within the next few minutes or the next day. That's fine. Also, if there's a question that's asked and you're not the appropriate person to answer it, then you should be locating the right person that will answer the question adequately and provide additional information. And again, deferring an answer to the next day, that's fine too, but it should be, if you're committing to the next day, you need to provide the answer the next day, not next week. So they're here for a limited time. So as much information that we can provide the auditors when they're on site is the best practice, because you don't want to have pending items, and that delays the audit, it delays the report. And clarify any misunderstanding. So if you didn't understand a question, or if there was, you were discussing a process and you feel that they didn't really understand, or you're not understanding them, there's nothing wrong with clarifying and having a chat about it and setting the record straight. The worst thing that you can do is leave the auditors with an impression that's not really true based on just a misunderstanding. Be professional at all times, because they're always observing. They're always looking and listening when they're on site. And listen actively. So don't think you know what they said. Know what they said or asked. So what happens after the audit? This is what we look like after an audit. We're exhausted with a ton of paper all around us. And I know I have some administrators in the crowd today, and they've been part of audits, and I think you look like this too. You have to inject some humor into it. So what happens after an audit? So of course, our performance is assessed based on the set criteria of whatever it is they're auditing. So if it's a tri-agency grant, well then the performance is going to be assessed against those guidelines, those policies. So again, it's set against criteria and standards. A written report is provided to the university after the audit is concluded, and it includes findings and observations and recommendations. So just because there might be an observation, it doesn't mean they're going to have a recommendation. Recommendation is usually when they find a weak point in our systems. Then they will say, you need to do this, this, and this to fix it, and we do need to fix it. But observations is just to bring to our attention things we might want to consider taking care of, making better, and things like that. A review of the findings, once the report is received, I usually get the report sent to me, and what I do is I then distribute it to all the parties concerned, which is usually the controller, which is usually VP Research, my colleague Marlene Boutet as well, Sonia, who leads the audits on our behalf. And what we do is we sit together and we review what are the findings and what are the recommendations. And then we start to discuss how are we going to implement any changes based on recommendations. And then we need to respond back to that report in a timely fashion. So as I said, a written response to the report is submitted to the auditor within a specified time. So they do give us a deadline to respond. It's not, we can't take our time and months of discussions. They usually give us maybe, what do they give us, Marlene, usually about a month or two for internal discussions, and then we need to provide what we call a draft response to the audit, and then they review our response and either accept or not accept. They might come back with comments, and then we respond back as a, maybe a final response, and they'll give us a final report with their recommendations and our responses. So our responses commits the university to change. So if we've said we're going to do this, this, and this by this date, and it's in the final report, they will expect that we do exactly what we said we would do. So it's very important in the response to include specific answers that are attainable, that are a timeline for implementation that is auditable, because they, when they come back to see if we implemented the recommendation, they're going to go through a trail to see how did they implement it, is everything okay? And we need to be clear and precise in what we're trying to achieve. And we should not be committing to implementing something when we know that we can't do it. So let's say, for example, we just lost a whole bunch of ISR people, and our recommendations and responses were based on IT solutions. Well, we know now that we might not be able to do that because we don't have resources to do that. So we have to be realistic about what we're going to commit to do. And if there is a change to what we initially committed, we need to be communicating with the agency, with the auditors, to say we're deviating from the plan because of these reasons. So we have to provide reasons, and I have to say they're very accommodating, and they will either give us extensions and or suggestions of how to go around a plan that's not going to work as we initially thought. Any questions so far? Okay. So what can we do to ensure successful audits? We need to make sure that everyone is trained. So whatever materials, when a new staff member comes on board, we need to be sure that we're training them on standard administrative procedures, on any guidelines pertaining to whatever agency he or she is administering. So be very in line with all the regulations. These people should attend internal meetings, the RAN, FST roundtables, If there are any checklists internally that are developed, they should be aware of them, and they should be very aware of the terms and conditions that are tied to each and every single research grant that we administer. It's very specific. These are public funds that are given to McGill University to administer, and we need to make sure that we do a good job of that. We need to ensure accuracy and compliance, and I'm putting here every time. So charge direct costs correctly. So that's all about planning. I think we need to be helping the researchers plan better how they spend their research funds. So if they have more than one grant, we should be helping them in allocating the costs to the right grants from the get-go. And this will avoid transfers of expenditures from one fund to another, which is something auditors don't like, and it's something granting agencies do not like to see, because that shows that we're not managing our grants appropriately. So we should be able, as best we can, to allocate expenses to the grants where they belong from the beginning. We should also be using the appropriate account codes. I know it's very easy to put everything into miscellaneous, but again, auditors drill down on that, and it doesn't show that we're on track with our expense account codes. We should be putting a payroll expense to a payroll account code. If it's a travel, it goes to a travel, equipment to equipment, books to books. We have many, many account codes. Let's make use of them. And be mindful of large purchases in the last 6 months. That's something that we see often in larger grants and or even smaller grants where there's a large balance at the end of the term. So what happens is there's a large balance at the end of the term, and within the last 3 months of that term, all of a sudden we're going to see a huge ticket high dollar ticket item hit the fund, like a huge piece of equipment or large material and supplies order and stuff like this. And that raises flags, because if it's the end of the term of a grant and it has a large balance, and now because we might potentially need to return that money because it wasn't spent, all of a sudden you're going to go buy a big piece of equipment, the auditor will question that. It's like, how are you going to use this when you're grant is ending in 2 months, and why didn't you purchase it at the beginning? So it raises a whole bunch of questions, not only for the PI, but even for the at the university level, because we're not managing it well. Did you want to add something there? No?
I think a lot of it, probably a lot of it has to do with being mindful of when the grants are projected to term. Be aware, pay attention to the end dates, 30, 60, 90 days ahead of time. Check those dates, run reports, and try and talk to your PIs to say, this is going to be terminating 6 months, we need to do something about this large balance so that, you know, we are spending them down in a more appropriate way and that we're not giving the funds to these large purchases at the end. Ask for no-cost extensions. Call us. Touch base with us. We'll be more than happy to contact the agencies 3 months ahead of time to say, hey, we need a no-cost extension. It's almost better to do a no-cost extension than to ticket these large items at the end of the grant. So again, you're our voice to investigators.
Marlene, except for the SHRC and NSERC, usually they won't give them the no-cost.
Correct. Yeah, we always have to go by agency.
So it's important even for those, because a lot of people end up wanting to have a GRF set up, and it's important that the researchers spend their money.
Yes, exactly. So there are eight granting agencies that we cannot get a no-cost extension over and above the one that's the automatic 1 year. So again, we need to adjust based on the granting agency, but we're there to help with that.
Thank you.
Does Miguel have, if you see a large purchase coming through, you know, March 15th and the grant's March 31st, does McGill have, can you deny, can that expense be denied, or how,
No. So the question was if a large expense is coming through on March 15 and the grant is ending March 31st, can we deny that expense? So yes, it will go through our approval queues. So if it's a piece of equipment, it will go through a purchase order and therefore through our approval queues. But as administrators, we cannot simply say, sorry, we're not going to approve this. So we have to approve it based on the reliability of the researcher, and then if it is audited, well, that researcher will be open to question, like it's going to be questioned for sure, and he'll have to respond to that. But we can't question the researcher's judgment on when or how or he purchases his equipment. It's a very sensitive matter. Ruth?
So the question was, who requests the no-cost extension? Who should be contacting who when there's a no-cost extension? So, I mean, short story, short answer, contact OSR. Contact the OSR awards team, and we will guide you. We're there to help make the contact with the granting agency. We sometimes can then look at the agreement or the notice of award and assess, do we have the authority as the Office of Sponsored Research to grant that no-cost extension? Sometimes we do. We are in a position that we can grant internal no-cost extensions, but we need to assess the terms of the award. For example, on contracts, we might need to go back to the company and do an amendment to the contract, but sometimes we do have the ability to do no-cost extensions because the contract says, well, until the project is done. But we still have to delineate an initial end date, because we have to for the fund, for InfoEd, we have to put an end date, but that end date might not be a true end date. So it's always best to contact us, have the PIs contact us. You can contact us on behalf of the PI, put the PI in copy, and we'll look into it, and then we'll say, well, no, we need to go back to the grant agency. And then for those purposes on a grant, we really should be providing the granting agency with what's left to be done. You can't just ask to say, oh, I got all this money and I want an extension. You really should have a scientific justification. I still need to do work on AIM-4. I need to do my final data analysis. Something. Anything. Exactly. Correct. No, but that's where get our help. We're there for that. So do not be shy of asking for OSR awards assistance. There's another
question. I think there was another question in front. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Or their staff to follow this very carefully, because sometimes things get missed because they have a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of accounts sometimes. Sometimes they don't have a way to keep track of this.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think everyone heard the question, but I'll repeat it for the sake of the recording, is whether or not our office, our FMS, monitors large balances when they're within 3 months of termination, or whether this is an onus that is on the PI and or their support staff. So I think that's a collaborative effort. We do look at these balances in central, but we're not the ones that are closer to the action, closer to the PI, to go and alert and to monitor every single fund he or she may have. Because some PIs have many, many funds. And they, you know, they spend down as they go. They look at it as one big pool. And that's why those things happen. It's not because of mismanagement or anything like that. So what we encourage is that the FSTs and the research support staff, that is yourselves, to be closer to them and to occasionally on a quarterly basis take a look at those balances, and if there's something that is ending, then just alert. You will note that sometimes they may have large balances in one fund, but they may be carrying an overexpenditure in another fund, and that's because expenses weren't allocated properly from the beginning. In those instances, it's just maybe a payroll Minerva appointment form that needs to be processed to transfer expenses back and forth. those are most of the cases that we see, but you're the best people to be nudging the researcher to go and make sure that he's spending down those balances. Yes, Anna.
There was supposed to be a report to help us. I guess you're working on that.
Yes.
Coming up?
Yes, it's coming up. We finally finalized it. I think it was last week, maybe. So we're just we're working on a communication, and that should be going out. We're hoping by the end, before we go on Christmas break, because we really want to get it out there. So Marlene and I are going to work on a communication, and it is coming. It's a wonderful report, and you're going to be able to see anything that's terming within 30, 60, 90 days. It's color-coded. I think it's going to be, and it is. It's really, really nice. We're very... We're very proud of the work that was done on that report. It was a big effort by a few people, so we will be unveiling that before Christmas, hopefully as your Christmas present. How about that? Yes, Elizabeth.
CIHRS, do they still allow you to have more than 25%, or is that rule still applies? Because you know, some of the PIs would like to save some money because, as also you say, you cannot decide about postdoc. The postdoc is delayed coming in when you offer them a position. So then you have a bigger than 25% balance.
I'm going to look at Cindy. I'm not sure if the 25% still applies. They don't really look at, yeah. So Amy's just going
to
jump in.
I'm just going to jump in for a second to explain that. I don't want to stand up and block LB. That the federal agencies can't pay in advance of need. So if your last installment is actually less than the amount remaining in the account unspent, at that point they cannot pay that last installment until the PI provides either a justification as how they're going to spend it down before the next payment is due, or they defer, and then so it means that it just gets deferred so the next year so that they spend down the balance. But basically the premise is that they cannot pay in advance of need. And that's a federal government thing. IDRC, CETA, they technically have that same requirement. So that's when it's not a 25%, 35%, it's an advance of need. That's all it is. They contact people directly. They're doing it right now, so many of you probably already saw it. What it is based on the form, the balances reported in the last Form 300, they go through and they identify people who are getting their last installment, and those people, the NSERC and SHRC, CIHR sometimes not as, they don't do this as religiously as SHRC and NSERC does, they will contact those PIs directly and say, this is the balance that was reported. You're scheduled to get paid this amount because it's 85%, was it, RFMS can correct me, but if it's 85% of the installment or more than that, that you're about to be paid, if your unspent balance exceeds that, they cannot pay you. So they go back to the PIs and they say either you defer or you provide us with a spending plan. And so in those cases, they make the PI spend down their balance before March 31st. So then April 1st, when the next payment comes, their balance is lower. Does RFMS have anything to add on that? That's straight, right?
Okay. Yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah.
And we're normally copied on those emails.
Yes.
That the PIs are sent those emails directly by the agencies. I'm copied, the administrator is copied, and your office is copied. And it's pretty quick, the responses back and forth from what I've seen.
Most of the time they just say, defer.
Defer.
They reply with one answer, okay, defer.
Thank you, Amy. Okay, so we'll just continue. So we need to also ensure expense eligibility. And how you can do that also, this is a difficult one for you to do because it requires an analysis or a review of monthly expenses in the PI's funds. So if he has many, many funds and you have many, many PIs, it becomes very difficult to do. We're doing this centrally a little bit through monitoring and compliance, although I wish I had a ton more resources on that team. We're limited, but we're doing the best we can with what we have. So we've developed some reports that give us ineligible expense expenses by account code. So we drive it that way. So if there are certain account codes that are not allowed on certain grants, it'll pop up on a report, and then we do some legwork, and we may involve the FSTs to remove some of these out of the funds that they're not supposed to be in. So we need to be mindful of that. And we need to ensure document completeness. When I say that, I mean that if there are journal entries being processed against a grant, for example, for whatever reason, an IDC, shared expenses, it needs to be documented in a way that when an auditor comes in and looks at it, they're not wondering what is it. And we've come across a lot of that whereby we don't even know how to explain it, because by the time it hits the fund, by the time it sits in the fund, then it gets audited. You're not going to remember what that transaction was all about. So if you're documenting it the right way, complete from the get-go, and the audit comes 5 years later, it should be, and you're not around, it should be anybody who's able to look at it and say, this relates back to this document, it's about that or that transfer, this shared expense. There shouldn't be a blank stare saying, I don't know what this was. So document completeness, because that's what we get, blank stares. And so we need to do a better job at that. Sub-award agreements, there's going to be a session in January, so I know you might have questions here, but we'll answer all of those in January. It's going to be an interesting session, I know, because there's a lot of questions that surround that. But when we issue monies to our partners, we need to monitor that those monies are also being spent down. Oftentimes, we're transferring lots of monies to our partners, and they report back these huge balances. So why are we sending these monies, first of all, if they're not spending it down? And we need to also monitor that they're spending it in accordance with the regulations of these granting agencies. So I'm asking that you keep a closer eye on that. I know it's not easy. Usually it should be the principal investigators who are authorizing those transfers to connect with their partners at those other institutions to see how's it going, how's the research going, do you need more funding, do you have enough funding, so on and so forth. Yes, those are sub-awards, yes. Okay. My favorite subject. So document. So if a document relates to the research grant and contract, well, then keep it. Don't shred it, don't destroy it, just keep it. Scan it. Less is not better. You know how we're always saying we have too much paper, we don't need this document or that document. From my experience with audits, the more documents you have, the better it is. Okay? Sandy's laughing because and Brenda, because we've all three been through CETA audits, which are very extensive audits, and they go back many, many years, and you cannot imagine the details that they request during an audit. So they have us searching for stuff going back many, many years, and they expect us to have those documents, as little as a document as a taxi receipt, correct? Yes. So less is not more in these instances. I really encourage you to document and retain all pertinent paper within your files or scan them. So that's why we want to ensure, and we're going to be providing a framework for record retention, because I know it's different in every faculty, and we're trying to see if we could come up with a common denominator so that we can even self-serve ourselves in case of an audit. How great would it be if there was an audit and then I didn't have to call any one of you and I could just go into a directory and pull whatever documents I need? So this is what we're striving for. This is what we've been working on for now for a while. We have a framework that we've come up with and developed. We're going to be introducing that framework to some faculty financial officers on Monday. And then we're going to see if we can adapt it across campus, and we'll see how that goes. But we're still working on that. We also have to ensure that the PI and or his delegate authorization or evidence of authorization is kept in a central repository as well. This is where we didn't do so well with the tri-agency, and it's not just tri-agency, it's also CETA, it's also NIH. They do want to see that the principal investigator has authorized every single charge that hits his or her grant. Okay? That's as little as even the feeds, like a telecom feed. It could be the animal resources feeds. All of these hit their funds right away without them seeing it, although they know that they're going to incur that expense. The agencies want to see evidence of that PI approval and or his delegate. So we need to do better in keeping that in a local repository. So the monitoring and compliance team performs regular cyclical reviews of certain transaction streams only for now. So we're testing expense reports, POPs, duplicate payments, P-cards, and we're also going to be introducing the BISA stream within the next fiscal year. And what we do there is we test all of these transactions against granting agency policy. So it's all research funds that we're testing against. And we want to try to be as clean as possible when a real audit comes our way. So by doing our internal compliant audits, this team is helping us ensure that we're ready for whatever audit comes our way in the future. So it's not a means to bother the faculties and or departments when we're asking for backup documentation. It's just to make sure that we're doing things right. And this is where we're catching things that are still not up to par. And it's by going through this exercise that we're going to be able to put in place what needs to be put in place and train the community. So put yourself in the shoes of an external auditor. Usually, they don't know too much about the research grant or contract that is being audited. They need to familiarize themselves as well with those agreements because they're usually people that have been hired to conduct the audit. And what would you be looking for if you don't know anything about the research agreement, you don't know anything about the PI, you don't know anything about McGill University? You need to be able to assess how the institution is performing. So you need to put yourself in those shoes. And when you're giving information to the auditor, you need to be giving them the information they need. I like those shoes. So I thought I'd put in the slide. I think some of you have seen this if you're part of the FST roundtables, and I'm not sure if we've shown this at this RAND session. No, we haven't shown this here. So these are ineligible and non-compliant transactions that keep coming up as findings when we're running our testing through monitoring and compliance. So we still see missing documentation, receipts, timesheets, offer letters, prospectuses for expense reports, meal receipts, hotel receipts. These things are still missing. Lack of evidence of the PI or delegate approval. We don't see that on all the documents. Still missing, still a big problem for us. We're seeing ineligible expenses, office and other supplies, and I know that's a biggie for everyone, so don't raise your hand. I know that that's a problem, and we're trying to see what we can do about that. The missing boarding passes, well, at the bottom you'll see a note of new, so we don't require the boarding pass if you can provide all the receipts that is able to place the person in the place. So hotel bill, taxi receipts, meal receipts. The affiliation of the claimant to the grantee, that's a biggie also that's still coming up. And I think that's an easy one to fix. I would love to see our next quarterly reports of findings that we're going to be sending to the faculties. I would love to see that go down because that's an easy one. It's a simple question and it's a simple documentation on an expense report. And you can imagine how happy the deans will be if they can see some of those things go down in our findings. Because right now it's a little bit plateaued across the board in these findings, and these easy ones, we can wipe them off those reports. I'm very confident that we can do that, so I ask for your help in helping us achieve that, and so we can all be proud that we've done that. And then I'm going to leave you with a supporting evidence requirement. So this is a chart that just details what we need for what type of transaction, and I'm not going to go over it, all of them. I think we have given this in other sessions as well, so I'm going to leave that for you to review on your own. But it gives you hints of every single thing that we would require in order to be in compliance with the granting agencies. So So these are just two examples of our recent audits and findings. So the tri-agency monitoring visit, as you know, was not a successful one. And it wasn't a successful one due to ineligible expenses, because that was so little, and we should be very proud of that aspect of the audit because we did really, really well there. But we did not do well when it came to document retention, supporting documents, and evidence of PI approval. And that was the reoccurring theme throughout the entire report. It was like every single finding went back to square one, where it was always about the document retention and evidence of PI approval. So these are the two findings, the main themes that we are really working hard in trying to resolve, and we really want to be doing so within the next couple of months, because we need to move on from the TRIG findings, which has become almost our full-time job. So what happened here is we weren't able to provide them with timesheets. So every time there was a POP transaction, a payroll transaction, we were not able to provide a timesheet on a timely basis. So sometimes we were able to provide it, but it was after 10 days. And after 10 days, it's too long. We should be able to be giving them back up within 2-3 days max. And we just couldn't come up with those documents to substantiate the charge on the ledgers. And so that's where we were with that. For the CETA audit that we had, and this one went back many years, we were knocked for not having a sub-agreement in place, and we transferred monies to the field without that sub-agreement. And unfortunately, this was a country where there were political issues, and so they could not provide us with any backup documentation when we went back to the field for that audit. And then it came to light that we did not have an agreement in place. So, of course, that entire amount was disallowed. It was very, very substantial. So, and then there were other things like the timesheets, like evidence of PI approval, like calculations on the timesheet. So they look at that. They don't just look at the bottom line. They will take a timesheet and they will do a recalculation of what's on that timesheet. They will look at how was it entered on that timesheet. I saw a timesheet just the other day where it looked like people fiddled with the amounts to make it come to a bottom dollar that they wanted it to come to. That is very wrong. So, I mean, very wrong. No. I frown upon that. So, so what happened is I saw actually two timesheets was brought to my attention this week, and I just could not believe it. And that's something that auditors will pick up and will disallow, because that looks like someone went in and manipulated the figures after the fact to add up to what they needed it to add up to. And that will be an observation on the quarterly reports to that department. It's something that's just not ethically correct. And I encourage you to not submit anything like that. It has to be clean, it has to be precise, and it has to be signed by the PI and or the delegate, and it cannot be questionable. So these types of things are things that were brought up, and fortunately enough, we made a trip to Ottawa for these CETA projects, and I was able to bring down that disallowance because I negotiated with the CETA officials, and they understood where we were coming from. However, it's not something I enjoy doing, and it's not something we should be put in a predicament to do. So we need to be clean. We need to not be sending monies out to other institutions if we don't have agreements in place, and we need to be able to substantiate every single expense that is hitting every single fund of ours. We need to be proud of those monies that are entrusted to McGill, and we need to be able to administer them properly. This was a contract that was also audited. It was a Canary contract. And here, too, we had a lot of disallowances. And it was also based on a lot of timesheets, payroll transactions that we could not, because auditors will come in and they will take an annual pay. So if it's a Minerva appointment form, they will go back and recalculate that entire pay. They will try and cross-check it with the benefits. And they do all their worksheets. And if it doesn't balance to what they're expecting it to balance per that agreement, they will disallow it. So that was another example of disallowances.
Sorry, a question on your slide. What does it mean, Minerva appointment form, lack of PI's authorization of labor distribution?
Yeah, so that's a Minerva appointment form when you're assigning how much is getting charged to which fund for the period of time.
Right.
That's a labor distribution. So we're not able, we don't have evidence of the PI saying charge LV Coletta's salary to this ENSER grant from May to April, from May to September for $30,000. We don't have evidence of that. So we can provide the appointment form because that's an online form. You need a, you need either an email from the PI authorizing. So the PI passing by and saying, can you please charge that? It's not good enough. Yes. Okay. Yes, Anna. Sorry, I'm sorry, I didn't. Lack of visibly defined roles. Okay, for the tri-agency, when they came for their monitoring visit in 2010, we never had at the university a set of roles and responsibilities that related to the research administration. So we didn't have a site where we could say, well, the FSDs clearly know their role and responsibility, and here it is, it's clearly defined, and it has been clearly communicated. We didn't have that. We didn't have roles and responsibilities for the PI, for finance, for our roles, for OSR, for anyone that was involved in research administration portfolio. We had them scattered here and there, but we didn't have it in a place where it was easily accessible by the auditors and or by the research community at large. So we couldn't point them anywhere, and therefore they defined that as a lack of training material, if you will, of and when somebody doesn't know what their role and responsibility is, then how do you expect them to carry out their roles and responsibilities on a daily basis? So we had to put that in place. Well, the roles and responsibility is not tied back to a job description. Job descriptions, as you've seen when they're posted, they're very generic. So we provide an internal, very small summary of what the role is, but then there is a generic, what you see on posted on the web is generic across the board. So they vary, and that's not something I can respond to because I'm not a HR professional. I'm not sure why they do that. But the roles and responsibilities, it ties back to the everyday operations of an FSD role and responsibility of support.
If I can add to that, well, I think our HR...
I think our HR does have some very generic job descriptions. Having said that, it is still our mandate to ensure that we provide these roles and responsibilities that really define a little bit better what our expectations are and what we need to do to protect against audit and ensure compliance. I can only give an example. For example, the people who in OSR apply to be a contracts administrator, a contracts officer, their job description has to do with planning and architecture, which has nothing to do with what we, but it's unfortunate, but that's how it is. So you can't, our job descriptions are vague, but the roles and responsibilities and what we're sharing within the RAN and all that is really what needs to govern how we conduct our day-to-day job.
And the roles and responsibilities are on the RAN site, right?
Yes. They are on the RAN site, yes. They've been widely distributed. So if you haven't read them, haven't seen it, we do, again, strongly recommend that you take the time to look at them.
Thank you.
There's another.
Joanne? Just a second. Stop it. You want to bring her the mic so she can. Then she'll stop banging it around.
Just a question on the lack of evidence of PI's authorization of expenses. At my level, how do I know that the expenses I'm approving have been authorized by the PI? Because we don't ask for approval. We take it from the whoever's putting it through that they work for that person, but we don't really see anything from the PI saying that, yeah, charge this to my fund.
But for the purchase requisition, it goes through their approval queues, so they're
approving. But other than that, but so that's fine like that?
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to double check.
And then for, expense reports, we're not looking at in our FMS, right, except if it's the Faculty of Medicine. And expense reports, we have a delegation menu that was presented at this RAND session, whereby whoever's approving that expense report at the local level needs to ensure that there's the PI and or the delegate authorization. They need to go back to the delegation menu in Minerva and check to see who is that delegate and ensure that that's the right person that's signing it.
It's just for the CFI. I know that the PIs actually have to send a signed requisition, copy of the requisition, before it's approved at our level.
Even better, yeah. Somebody's checking it, the signed requisition. If the PI has to sign it, then there's your control.
Yeah, for CFI.
Yeah.
But for any other expenses other on other funds, we don't ask for a signed copy of the requisition by the PI.
Well, MMP, for example, it's either the PI and or the delegate, and that's in MMP. It's recorded already. So the systems have already accommodated some of the delegates. MMP will be set to zero. It's a requirement of tri-agency, so has it been already?
Well, because there was a threshold of $1,000.
Yeah, now it's going to be zero.
Right. Yes.
So we solved that problem. Any other questions?
Can I add something for the timesheets? The template for the timesheets will be revised soon, I think, right? Where there will be a line that will say PI or delegate signature required, where before it used to just say supervisor, so that will be changed very soon. And there will be, in the Minerva delegation menu, there will be timesheet added in there so that the PIs can delegate an authorized person to sign on his or her behalf those timesheets. So that's where the timesheets will have to be signed by the PI or by an authorized delegate. And then the question will be maintaining them so that they can be accessed.
Well, the authorized delegate has to be somebody else who's labeled too.
Somebody who, I'm sorry, the question is?
Yes, like a PI too has to be a PI.
It has to be a PI or it has to be, think of a grant, this is my opinion, but this is how I would manage it, is that basically a grant is like a bank account. So the delegate is somebody that you trust who has the ability to say that the expense is appropriate for this grant. So it could be a research associate. It doesn't have to be another faculty member. If your research associate or your senior lab manager or your program manager is aware of what's going on in the lab, it's appropriate. They know what's happening. They know that this person did come in on this day and did work on this day. It would be an appropriate authorized delegate.
I think the best practice, Ruth, over the years has always been to have a PI delegate to a co-PI or to a peer or to a higher person. However, the tri-agency does not dictate who the PI can delegate to. So we did include in the Minerva delegation menu, we have a very clear paragraph on who that delegate can be, and it has to be someone, like Marlene said, who's entrusted, who is knowledgeable of the grant. So those are the people that he or she may choose to delegate to. So it's not, the agencies are not dictating who that person should be. It's a decision the PI needs to take in a responsible manner to assign someone who he or she can trust to manage his or her research grants. Yes.
People who are doing ban feed, so do they have also to have PI's approval each time you process a feed?
Yeah, that's something we're working on. So the question was, what about the feeds? Do we need to have the PI's authorization on every single feed that is being processed? And the answer is yes. We had a conference call with the tri-agency just 2 weeks ago, and we were struggling with this one back and forth, but the answer always comes back to yes, we do need the PI's approval. So we're looking at ways right now. We're meeting with quite a few areas. In the next couple of weeks, we've invited many feed areas to meet with us. I'm going out to meet with a couple of them by the end of November. Pardon me?
We're meeting next week.
Oh, we are? Okay, good. So we're going to be trying to come up with either a form or a mechanism. What we really want to do is the stores, the chemical stores, the animal facility, biology stores, all the stores, internal stores, the best way would be to put them onto MMP. But we don't have the IT resources right now to accommodate all of them at the same time. So we're going out to see what can we implement in the meantime and then eventually get them onto MMP. So it's coming, but we do need approval on those feeds. Good question. Okay, next slide. So our U.S. federal audit requirements, our U.S. friends, because we do have U.S. grants that we administer. So we do have NIH, U.S. Army, NSF, and we will be having our first A-133 audit in 2016. We had a monitoring visit in 2012, March of 2012, by our friends from the audit in the U.S., and they came to audit our NIH grants. They didn't pick any specific grants. It was more based on compliance and our internal structures. And, of course, there were some findings there. They were findings that we are aware we had. And so what we're doing is we're setting up another internal committee to start looking at all the items that we may not be compliant with when it comes to these U.S. grants so that we're prepared for the 2016 visit. This is the first time McGill gets one of these audits. It's a very extensive audit. Marlene, who worked in the U.S. For many years at Rochester, has experience with this. In her mind, it's an easy thing, but for McGill, it's really not because it's something unknown to us. We also have to contract special auditors for this because our Canadian auditors are not familiar with this type of extensive audit. It's not one of the typical audits we've ever had. Findings on this type of audit will result in returning monies to these granting agencies or to the U.S. government, as well as the institution can possibly be fined for any wrongdoing or any non-compliant when it comes to this. So this is a very serious audit. We don't have many, many U.S. grants, so for the amount of grants we have, this audit is very, very big and intensive, and we want to be prepared for it so that we can say, yes, we know that's a finding, but we already have a fix for it. So we're going to be working very hard within the next couple of months or years to prepare for this audit, and we've already, we have a committee put together, and we're going to start work on this in January. So just to say that this is coming soon, so we're going to move from the trig and we're going to get into the A-133. And finally, how do the audits help us? So again, they can be used as a tool for improvements. They guide process enhancements. They identify areas where we do require improvements. They also identify best practices, and these are sometimes shared with other institutions, so it's nice if we get a gold star on best practices, and McGill does have some. And it helps us build partnerships with our sponsors. Over the years, we've become really a partner with our sponsors, with our agencies. Together, we're working to get things done as they should be, so if we don't understand something, they're really open to communicating with us. We have frequent conference calls with them. We email with them, and so they're really, it's really a nice thing to see the partnership grow with our sponsors. And that's it for my presentation. Any questions? Ruth.
Yeah, it's just because you have meeting with the financial officers and the faculties, and they meet the AAs, and the AAs supervise the staff. Can we just remind them to tell the support staff, coordinators, or whatever, because some of them, they do transactions for professors. And sometimes they forget that the professor organizing event and everything, they post to the miscellaneous because it's not clear when they take the individual transaction and instead of take the event like a conference or, you know, I has noticed a lot of courses that the professor now are having meetings with companies that are coming, or they organize something with the students. So the any supplies that they bought, they are putting in the miscellaneous expense in place of looking as an event that should be under the account event. But mm-hmm. I think that is something that should be reminded to the AAs to discuss with their staff, mm-hmm. because most of these staff doesn't come to these meetings. So they doesn't understand. They think it just because the PI say, yes, put it, and just it's not a specific account that say, I'm buying food for this, they forget about it.
That's a very good point, Ruth. Thank you. I have been invited to attend the Faculty of Medicine. They're starting to implement their FST, so I've been invited to provide post-award financial management training to the Faculty of Medicine. So I just did one on Monday. I will be going to two more in December, and Marlene is joining me at some of these. With the monitoring and compliance, our findings and observations are going to be communicated to the faculty financial officers. We will go and meet with them personally, and we will be relaying these types of messages to them so that it filters down to those people who are processing these transactions. Thank you. Hi.
Will you be updating the account codes? Because they're not up to date, and I'm actually handwriting, and I'm keeping a list, like translations, and you know we go through a lot of those in our department.
Yeah. I'm not the custodian of the account codes, so I'm not the one that manages that extensive list of account codes. So if you do have any that are missing, or any that you need, or any that are incorrect in your view, you need to contact Peter Karachik in reporting accounting. And they'll be able to assess when what is needed or not needed.
Because, like in when we do conferences and they do printing on their posters and stuff like that, there is no printing. They don't know, so we have to always go in and change it. Do you think it's a possibility to add that in Minerva printing?
We could take that back
to 70010, right? They put it in miscellaneous, so we have to always go back and change it. So they don't know, even though we tell them, they're not going to remember. So it was just...
We'll take that back, and I'll see what can be done, and we'll let you know. Thank you.
I was just wondering how much of the supporting documentation has to be physical paper, and how much could be scanned documents?
We believe that the scanned documents is the way to go. So if you can scan, that's the best practice. And they have to be legible, though. When you're scanning them, they need to be of good quality.
Thank you. I just had a question about... typically, what's the role of the PI when an audit happens? Like, if an audit is happening on their fund, what roles and responsibilities does the PI have in that process?
That's a very good question. Typically, in the tri-agency grants, when we had the tri-agency monitoring visit, there were meetings scheduled with the PIs, but not by me. The auditors scheduled those meetings with the PIs directly. Their involvement is really not at the transaction level, so they're not involved in submitting documents of expense reports and all of this. We facilitate that. That's our job. The meeting that they have with the auditor is basically to go over their research, the scope of their research, how's it coming, how's it going, as well as what is the support that's given and provided to them at the university level. So those are the discussions that are had with the PI, and that's basically their involvement on a tri-agency type grant. On a CETA grant, the involvement of the PI is very much so. They're involved not with, again, the transactions, because we, again, accumulate all of this, but if there are questions on the transactions, the CETA auditors will want to meet with the PI as well. So the PI is very involved in CETA audit. So it depends the agency and how they work it. But because, let's say, CETA audits and projects are very big projects, multi-million dollar projects most of the time, the PI is very much involved from the beginning. We have an opening meeting, we have meetings throughout, and we have a closing meeting. So it's very intense when it comes to those types of audits. Good?
Hey,
Well, thank you. Did you have something else?
Unrelated. As Brenda mentioned, the OSR offices will be closed for the two holiday weeks. There will be a notification that will be emailed out Monday to the wide distribution throughout campus. And when you get that email, we'll circulate it through the RAN listserv as well. But if you hear of any PIs that are going to be submitting a grant for due date January 1, January 2, January 3, unfortunately, we do have granting agencies that have those deadlines. The signatures have to be obtained by OSR before we close for those 2 weeks. So there's going to be a lot of planning that's going to be needed on our PI's behalf. So it'll be important to circulate that email widely as possible to make sure that they see it. We will be sending out a communication on Monday. We're going to send it out on our funding opportunity listservs. It'll be posted on our website. We'll send it through the RAN. But, you know, a lot of our PIs don't see that. So feel free to forward and make sure that they see it. Because if they hit a door, they're not going to like it. I'm sorry? Exactly. Nail it wherever they can see it. Bathroom doors. I don't care.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. We'll see you in December.